And you're listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial, and the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca, our online streaming service. And it wasn't too long ago that Stephen Gowans gave a lecture to McMaster University students in the Labor Studies program, and that was about Canadian foreign policy and why it matters to workers. And I'm very pleased to say we have Stephen on the line to discuss that with us now. So, Steve, thanks very much for being on the program with us today.
Oh, you're welcome, Brendan.
Yeah, it's been a while, and I know you briefly talked about this subject with the Taylor Report this week, but we have a lot of time to really look at the serious matters you brought up in this discussion, and I'm glad that these kind of lectures were taking place. Canadian foreign policy does matter a lot to citizens of this country, but it's not something we get a lot of instruction on. I mean, as you pointed out, the newspapers and TV and internet in this country cover a lot of subjects, you know, celebrity gossip, sports news, you know, weather, business, sometimes government decisions that people can understand the impact on their life. But it seems that the hardest thing to get valid information on, and maybe the easiest thing we can get hoodwinked on, is foreign policy. So I'm wondering why you think that is.
Yeah, well, I mean, foreign policy is a really difficult subject to grasp because it's about things that happen in remote corners of the world, you know, with which we usually have no direct experience. So it's difficult to get an intuitive feel based on personal experience of what's going on the ground. And then, as you say, I mean, the major source of information about foreign policy for most people is the news media. And the practice of the news media is really to report what government and state officials have to say, you know, whether it's from the White House or the State Department or the House of Commons or the Department of National Defense, wherever. So, in other words, I mean, the news media is passing along the official view or what people in government in the state would like the public to understand, which may not be the whole truth or even close to it. John Pilger, the journalist and filmmaker, I was watching a documentary he did in which he confronted a number of media executives in the UK about the way in which they covered the US-British invasion of Iraq. And he said, you know, look, I mean, the case for that invasion was completely contrived. It was fabricated. And yet the way in which you reported it would lead people to believe that, in fact, the United States and Britain had a valid case. And their response was, well, you know, it's just our job to report what the government says. It's up to everyone else to decide whether what they say is true or not. So when you think about the media, simply what it's doing is presenting a particular state of or a point of view. It's not doing it in a critical way, and it's presenting the point of view of those who may want you to believe a certain set of things that may not, in fact, be close to the truth. So when it comes to foreign affairs, you're seeing matters through a lens provided by the government or the state in a way you wouldn't do on domestic affairs, because on domestic affairs you have personal experience with the matters domestic affairs is about. For example, job policy or taxation or policies respecting unions or social programs and so on. So you can judge what you're being told against what you know from your own personal experience. If you take, for example, the federal government proposal to reduce employer EI premiums on the grounds that this will create jobs, you know, you can use your own experience to evaluate whether this claim is convincing. But when someone tells you that something's happening halfway around the world in a country you've never visited and perhaps have never really heard about until now, and then they put forward a proposal about what must be done in that country, you have no personal experience on which to draw to make any kind of evaluation of whether what you're being told is true or reasonable or against your interests or compatible with them. And, you know, if domestic policy can be against your interest, and it often is, well, maybe foreign policy can be against your interest too. But how do you determine whether it is or not? Well, unfortunately, the mass media isn't really helping you out if the mass media sees its goal as simply passing along information that comes from high state officials or major politicians.
Yes. I mean, one term that's been applied to that situation is stenographers to power. that the mass media here are just transcribing what officials and unnamed officials are saying about foreign policy. Fair and balanced goes out the window when it comes to foreign policy. You know, as you say, if there's a labor dispute or business policy or something that comes up, the media might interview the business or government side, and if you're lucky, they might talk to the labor unions, for example. But if there's a problem over with Iraq or Syria, they'll talk to the Pentagon, but they're not going to talk to President Assad, or they're not going to talk to critics of military intervention.
No, and they don't. Yes, they always show the official view or the view of official allies. For example, coverage of conflict between Palestinians and Israelis. The media will always tell you what it is that Israeli officials have to say, but they very rarely tell you about what it is that Palestinian or representatives of Palestinians have to say about certain matters. So, yeah, I mean, there's an unmistakable bias in mass media reporting of foreign affairs, which favors the government and the state.
Yes, and you mentioned John Pilger, for example, and he's done excellent reporting as far back as the outset of the Iraq crisis and the war in 2002, 2003, and more recently on issues such as Ukraine, some of his best work. I know it's people like John Pilger who have noted that when it's time for the U.S. to bomb another country, they trot out all these so-called experts, and generals and think tank people, which is often the same thing, and they tell us why it's important to bomb some country or send ground troops, but they don't talk to the anti-war movement. They don't talk to people who were demonstrably right about the nasty consequences of attacking Iraq back in 2003. You look at organizations like FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. They've noted that you have something like one anti-war commentator for every 20 pro-war commentators, you know, whenever the U.S. is lining up another conflict. So I think you're very right to say that there's a definite bias when we're talking about foreign policy. You've mentioned that there is this imbalance and this difficulty in getting information. But, you know, it has to come down to what the goals of foreign policy are or how it operates, why it operates. And you've done a lot of investigating on that. And I think you pointed out that everyone has a theory on how Canadian foreign policy operates. Everyone is a philosopher in that sense, whether we know it or not. And you mentioned that people probably have some kind of operating theory about why Canadian foreign policy works the way it does. So what are some of those theories that people might have in their heads about our foreign policy?
Well, I mean, one prevalent theory in Canada is that Canada is traditionally a peacekeeping country. And that we've been diverted from this traditional peacekeeping role by the neoconservatism of Stephen Harper. And there's a corollary to that, and that is that if the conservatives are defeated in the next election, that Canada will return to its traditional peacekeeping role. So that's a theory which has, from which you could derive a prediction. You might carry around in your head the theory that the foreign policy of Canada and its Western allies is motivated by lofty, praiseworthy goals like promoting democracy and respect for human rights or preventing genocide or protecting vulnerable populations. The government would certainly like you to believe that, and that's the kind of theory that's often presented in the mass media, principally because they're simply repeating what it is that government officials say, and that's the way in which government officials like to promote interventions in other countries. Or you may believe that the foreign policy is formulated as a response to a world that's teeming with multiple threats and that a myriad of groups and countries seek to harm us. So often you'll see politicians trying to elevate threats presented by other countries or other groups as a way of justifying intervention against those countries or groups. For example, North Korea is often presented as a very, very scary place that's a very real and frightening threat to Canada or to the United States or to the Western world. But when you start looking at the military capabilities of North Korea, you discover that North Korea is a very small country with a very puny military budget and that it presents no real threat at all to the Western world. Or there's ISIS. defense secretary in the United States was trying to build ISIS into the greatest threat that has ever, that the United States has ever faced, ever. Greater, presumably, than Germany or Japan in World War II. And that's a gross exaggeration, but that's one, as a result of that, that's one theory that some people can carry around in their head, is that, you know, the world is teeming with multiple threats, and foreign policy is all about protecting us from the myriad of groups and countries that seek to harm us.
Yeah, and I know you've evaluated that self-defense theory. We could talk about that, but I know you've really been looking into what drives our policy, what actually appears to be the motivating characteristics of Canadian foreign policy abroad. I think one of the helpful things you did in your lecture to students was to compare your thesis here to what our foreign policy might look like if labor unions, for example, were directing Canada's foreign policy. So if you had labor unions, the labor movement, organizing and directing Canada's foreign policy abroad, or some kind of extremely worker-centered foreign policy, you know, what would some characteristics of that might be?
Yeah, and I kind of presented that as a thought experiment, because I should say if many people carry around theories in their head, that what I've wanted to do is present a counter theory or a different theory, and the different theory is based on a consideration of who makes foreign policy in Canada, so who shapes it and who influences it. And the second part of it is an inference, which the inference is that whoever makes foreign policy and whoever shapes it and whoever influences it does so to promote a benefit from for themselves. So it's kind of a thought of experiment. I've asked, you know, so who does make foreign policy in Canada? I mean, we know it's made in Ottawa by politicians. At least politicians sign off on foreign policy. But, you know, is it made in a vacuum? Or do politicians get together with officials from the Department of Foreign Affairs and put together a policy without reference to anyone else in the country or without reference to very powerful allies like the United States? Or do they receive inputs from various groups? You know, are there interests of certain groups more likely to be considered than the interests of others? And are there some groups that have money and resources to get their point of view across in Ottawa to a degree that others don't? So, you know, when politicians and bureaucrats sit down to put together foreign policy, what do they do? I mean, you could do this as a thought experiment. What do they do? Do they sit down and do they say, you know what, there's certain benefits we want to achieve in our relationship with foreign countries? And the kinds of benefits we want to achieve are more job security for our workers at home, or better pay and better working conditions for our workers at home, or full employment. Or we want to expand the amount of free or nearly free public services like transportation and health care and child care and education. Or we want policies that help trade unions rather than undermining them. I mean, did they sit down and say, you know, these are our goals and these are our priorities, and now what do we do in the way we manage our affairs with foreign countries to make that happen? Or is it that when politicians and bureaucrats get together to make foreign policy, they say something like this? They say, you know, the benefits we want to achieve in our relationship with foreign countries are increasing the number of Canadian firms doing business in overseas markets, or deepening commercial engagement in Africa and Latin America and Asia, or do we want to promote and protect investment opportunities overseas for Canadian investors and business owners? So, I mean, you can ask, which of these two scenarios do you think is really closer to what actually goes on in Ottawa? And if you can't decide, but I think most people intuitively can grasp which is the more realistic scenario, but if you couldn't decide, all you have to do is go visit the website of the Department of Foreign Affairs and look up the priorities of the department, because they're listed there. It's public. And what you'll discover is that, in fact, the priorities of the Department of Foreign Affairs match the second scenario that I've just presented. So they say our priorities are increase the number of Canadian firms doing business in overseas markets, deepen commercial engagement in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, focus on investment promotion and protection, ratify the Canada-EU Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement to protect the profitability of investments in Europe. So, I mean, clearly these are priorities aimed at providing a benefit to a certain sector of Canadian society, not average Canadians and not workers and not organized labor and not unions, but shareholders and bankers and business owners and people with money to invest. So, in short, these are the priorities of corporate Canada, and these are the priorities that inform our foreign policy.
You did look at the mechanism to some degree of how that works. So how are corporations and investors able to influence government policy?
One way is through lobbying. So, I mean, the corporate community is this vast network of lobbyists representing its point of view to government. And there's no other sector of Canadian society that lobbies the government to the degree the corporate community does, because there's no other sector of society that has as much money. And, you know, large corporations have entire departments dedicated to pressuring government officials to accommodate their interests. Industries have lobbyists to represent the common interests of their industry. And then there are lobby groups representing the corporate community as a whole. And they are continually pressing government to adopt policies that serve the interests of the corporate elite. They're in Ottawa, all day, every day. And there's no other sector in Canadian society that has the kind of presence in Ottawa that the corporate community has. The government and the state are receptive to the corporate community also because the people who occupy high-level positions in government and the state are very likely to come from very high-level positions in the corporate community. We can take the example of Nigel Wright, who was the former chief of staff for Stephen Harper. Before he joined Harper's, or the prime minister's office, he was managing director of the investment firm Onyx, and he held positions on various corporate boards before joining the prime minister's office. When he left the prime minister's office, he went back to Onyx, and he was in the newspapers yesterday for doing a big deal. I mean, he's now managing director of Onyx, working out of London. So this is the revolving door. I mean, people who hold high-level positions in the corporate community move into high-level positions in public service, and then they return to the corporate community, and then they often come back into public service again and again. So these high-level representatives of the corporate community are playing very senior roles in public service. And then related to this is the practice of the corporate community offering very lucrative senior executive positions or appointments to boards of directors to politicians when their careers in politics come to an end. And politicians know that if they play their cards right while they're in office and they indulge the corporate community, then there's a reward waiting for them when they end their political careers. You can look at a number of provincial premiers in Canada and look at what happens to them when their careers in politics ends. And you can see that many of them move into positions of, or get appointments on boards of directors. And then there are think tanks that the corporate community funds. And these think tanks exist to bring together university professors and journalists and corporate executives to formulate foreign policy, which is then recommended to the government. The think tanks present themselves as being kind of neutral, neutral organizations which are looking in a dispassionate way at the policy that Canada should adopt, but they're kind of front organizations for corporate Canada because that's who it is that provides their funding. So the foreign policy think tanks in Canada include, I mean, there's the C.D. Howe Institute, the Fraser Institute, Canadian Defense and Foreign Affairs Institute. There's a number of them, all of which get their funding and their direction from the corporate community.
Yes, I mean, the Fraser Institute, for example, has been instrumental in changing Canadian domestic policy as well as foreign policy. Mm-hmm. Now, many of the neoliberal so-called reforms over the last couple decades or more propelled in part by institutes like the Fraser Institute. But you've shown how this conglomeration of corporate, business, military, and other interests are able to have great influence in government and influence the way government perceives our foreign policy needs. And the way Canada and the United States perceive other countries seems to be driven by this business investment climate. There's the example of the listings and rankings of countries along indexes of economic freedoms. You've talked a bit about that before. I mean, what are the top countries and what are the bottom countries in these, you know, indexes of investment freedom?
Yeah. And I should mention, just before going to that, I mean, another way in which the corporate community influences or has its say and or exercises such an enormous influence over foreign policy of the country is through their ownership of the mass media. We talked about this at the beginning, about people getting their views about foreign politics through the mass media, and the mass media simply passing along the official view. But we should also recognize that the mass media are owned by the large business. They are large businesses. They're part of the corporate community, and they reflect the interests of the corporate community in the same way a newspaper that was owned by trade unions would reflect the interests of labor. And, I mean, no one would bat an eye if you said, well, you know, that's a labor-owned newspaper, therefore it has a labor bias. Well, by the same token, mass media owned by large businesses will necessarily have a large business bias. So if we talk about the index of economic freedoms, the index, one index that's put together is the index developed by the Wall Street Journal and the Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation being a conservative foundation founded by the Coors family. There's also an index that's put together by the Fraser Institute. And it kind of corresponds to the one put together by the Wall Street Journal and Foundation, or the Heritage Foundation. So what these indexes do, or the indices do, is they try to rank countries on the basis of how attractive the country's foreign investment and business climates are. And if you look at the very bottom of the index, that's an interesting place to start. If you go to the very bottom of these indices, you'll find countries that often appear in the mass media as terrible places, you know, bad guys. These people aren't our allies. So you'll find Cuba and Venezuela and Libya when it was under Gaddafi and Iran. And that's kind of significant because all of these countries, which really become targets for efforts by Western countries to change the government there, they're targets for these regime change operations that we often hear about. They all appear at the bottom of this list. So in other words, all of the countries in which Western powers are interested in changing the government happen to be countries that have investment climates and business climates that major corporations or the corporate community and Western powers do not find to be particularly attractive and find, on the contrary, they find them to be repellent. On the other hand, if you look at the countries that appear at the top of the list, these are countries that Western powers are allied with and would never have exhibit any interest in changing the regime in.
Well, it's just, it's interesting because you would assume if you went along with the way our corporate media presents information, you might assume that the top countries on that list, the best countries for investment, are also ones with the best human rights record, their democracies, their free countries, you know, that there's a correlation between friendliness to investment and globalization and so forth, a correlation between that and human rights. But I think you found that not to be the case. So could you explain?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's often said that, you know, if Canada intervened in Libya, as we did when Libya was under Gaddafi, and we participated in the air war against Libya, this is presented as a humanitarian exercise, and Gaddafi was presented as someone who did not respect human rights and that we are intervening to promote a democracy and to promote human rights. Now, that's something we might say because it's difficult to garner support for your policy if you were to say, well, the real reason we're intervening in Libya is because, you know what, the Libyan economy is not one that's particular, the Libyan government doesn't maintain an attractive foreign investment climate or business climate. So if you look at some of the countries that are near the top of the list, top of the Heritage Foundation and Wall Street Journal Index in terms of attractive investment climates, you'll find some countries that are not particularly praiseworthy in terms of their human rights record. For example, Saudi Arabia is near the top of the list. And Saudi Arabia has a reprehensible human rights record. In fact, Saudi Arabia is probably has the worst human rights record on earth. You'll find Bahrain. Bahrain is loved by foreign investors and by the business community because it has a very, very attractive investment climate. But Bahrain is a country that is essentially, it's an authoritarian country, it's essentially a royal dictatorship. There's no real democracy in Bahrain. There's no real respect for human rights in Bahrain. There was an Arab Spring uprising in Bahrain where people said, you know what, we want a government that is elected by the people and not appointed by the king. And that uprising was crushed violently by the Bahrainian authorities with the assistance of Saudi tanks and troops. So there's no correlation between respect for human rights and democracy and the attractiveness of a country's investment or business climate.
Well, in the case of Libya, you pointed out in your article and your lecture, there had been complaints by foreign business persons and business organizations, and they're saying, you know, Gaddafi is an economic nationalist, and what that means is his country as a whole is taking too much of a cut in the oil proceeding. So the way Libya was operating was revenues that came out of international trade and operations out of oil and other resources in Libya were distributed in some capacity so that Libyans could have free education and other forms of subsidies, including subsidized fuel and such. And investors were looking at that and saying, you know, Libya is taking too much of a cut of Libyan oil. But if we get rid of Gaddafi, if Gaddafi were no longer there, we could conceivably have a higher cut.
Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to contrast Libya with Bahrain. So, I mean, Gaddafi has always been demonized and presented as kind of a clown, but what we're not told is that he was very interested in foreign investment contributing to the development of his country. So in Libya, there was screening of foreign investment. So if you wanted to invest in Libya, the government had to take a look at what you proposed to do and decide whether it was good for Libya. They also imposed conditions on investment and said, well, if you're going to invest in Libya and you're going to make money as a result of investing in Libya, you also have to contribute to the economy by reinvesting some of your profits. And we also want you to employ Libyans. You can't just come here and take all of our oil and at the end of the day leave us with a hole in the ground. And WikiLeaks had cables from the State Department that had been leaked. In which the complaints were being, the U.S. State Department was complaining about this and saying, you know, Gaddafi's practicing resource nationalism and he's telling the oil companies that they have to hire Libyans, and this is completely intolerable. On the other hand, they love Bahrain, and if you look at Bahrain, Bahrain doesn't screen foreign investment. Bahrain doesn't tell foreign investors that they have to reinvest in Bahrain's economy. Bahrain doesn't tell anyone that they have to employ people who live in Bahrain. So investors love that kind of climate because there are no obligations on them to actually contribute to the development of the Bahraini economy, but they hated, for them, Libya under Gaddafi was a nightmare for investors because Gaddafi was saying, you know, I'm not going to accept the attitude of all for us and none for you. You have to make a contribution to the society if you're going to take something out of it. And unfortunately, to the U.S. State Department and to the corporate interests that dominate foreign policy, that's a completely intolerable attitude.
Yes, well, they became very upset. And you know, when there was this challenge to Gaddafi's government, this armed challenge in which people started attacking government buildings and police forces and so on, our media portrayed that challenge to Gaddafi as a peaceful uprising. It called the people, the armed people who were involved in violent acts. It called them activists and pro-democracy protesters and so on. And, of course, now those people have been given full control of Libya, and we've seen the situation. It's a total catastrophe. And but despite that, we don't hear about the catastrophe that is occurring now, except insofar as it would justify further intervention into Libya because they've been unable to stabilize it. So there were a lot of tears flowing for things that they said Gaddafi might be doing or was about to do, but we don't have that kind of screaming about Bahrain or Saudi Arabia. And when Saudi Arabian government cuts someone's head off, you know, beheads someone the same way ISIS does, we don't hear about it. We don't know their names. We don't know what they're accused of. It doesn't appear in the Globe and Mail. It doesn't appear in the Hamilton Spectator unless a Canadian happens to be involved. Then, in Bahrain, that uprising was mercilessly crushed, and it was crushed with armored vehicles. It was crushed with rubber bullets. It was crushed with tear gas. It was crushed with people being taken away by police and never seen again. That sort of thing was happening, and where it wasn't happening was in the front pages of our newspaper. So this, you know, to our investment class and to our newspapers, the atrocities in Bahrain, which were quite significant, and the regular atrocities in Saudi Arabia are just not worth our attention. You looked at the whole humanitarian dimension very briefly in the sense that they're always trying to get us to support an intervention against a government they don't like by referring to a humanitarian cause and the need to make things better. And this led you to conclude in one respect that Western militaries, Canada, the United States, the UK, France, they're not really used in self-defense, you know, because if you had a self-defense, it would imply certain characteristics of how your army and navy operates. But Iraq was never a threat to the US or the UK or Libya or anything. But, you know, interestingly, eventually all these operations do create the threat of blowback. You mentioned this in the case of ISIS, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it creates the threat of blowback, and the government knows about this. I mean, CSIS has warned that we've been in the top five of Al-Qaeda targets, and ISIS is essentially Al-Qaeda. We've been in the top five for over a decade. And they also acknowledge for three reasons. One, because we sent the military into Afghanistan. Two, because Ottawa supports Israel against the Palestinians. And three, because we've sent CF-18s to bomb ISIS positions in Iraq. So, you know, we can ask, did the Taliban government in Afghanistan pose a threat to Canada? No. Do the Palestinians' efforts to achieve self-determination pose a threat to Canada? No. Did ISIS pose a threat to Canada before we joined the campaign to, you know, degrade and ultimately eliminate it? No. So none of these are threats, but intervening against them created a threat by angering people in the Muslim and Arab worlds and created the threat of blowback, which is, you know, you've done something to us that have made us angry, and so we're going to retaliate.
Well, the United States is propping up very unpopular governments in the Arab world, unpopular governments like that in Bahrain or Saudi Arabia, which, you know, seems to, you know, barely be able to survive without having an enormous amount of U.S. military aid and support for these governments and the protection of them from international criticism. There's great anger throughout the Middle East about the situation in Palestine, for example. The governments that are U.S. clients are not very responsive to this situation because they know where their bread is buttered. In the case of ISIS and Syria, I mean, look, the groups that became ISIS were rampaging through that country since 2011. You know, they were committing every atrocity under the sun. As you point out, beheadings, child killing, rape, artillery attacks on civilian areas. I mean, there's the whole destruction of precious monuments and serious cultural heritage. A lot of that was done by outsiders and local extremists, and they eventually did get into the whole beheading thing, and they were beheading Syrians, they were beheading Arabs for quite some time in Syria, but this was not something that we saw in our newspapers or on, the TV news or on internet news. It was not considered newsworthy. In fact, I mean, at that time, and as it still does today, the Canadian and U.S. governments were celebrating what they called freedom fighters, the so-called Free Syrian Army, revolutionaries, and what they're calling moderate rebels. Moderate rebels. I think you've pointed out in other forums, I mean, moderate seems to mean the willingness to adhere to U.S. goals.
Yes. It's the degree to which they're willing to be directed by the United States and other Western powers. They're certainly not moderate in the sense that they're not Islamists, because the Free Syrian Army is made up of, it's predominantly an Islamist group. I mean, most of these, the rebels are violent Muslim fundamentalists.
You're talking about a group that has a similar ideology to what's practiced in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, ISIS's ideology is based on the official ideology of Saudi Arabia, like this 18th century kind of harsh version of Islam. And it's really quite astonishing the degree to which there's this horror about ISIS in Iraq and the horror about ISIS when it chops off the heads of, you know, Western aid workers or Western journalists. And yet at the same time, ISIS has been committing so many atrocities in Syria, as barbarous, if not more barbarous, and little is said about that. And in fact, they simply say, well, you know, those are rebels trying to oust the Assad government. Somehow, you know, ISIS only became this extreme threat and this terrible barbarism when it started threatening the Iraqi government, which Canada and the United States support.
Yeah, I mean, and you've pointed out, this kind of fundamentalism, beheadings, killing people for sectarian reasons, the kind of dangerous bombings that they're involved with, this is not something that has wide appeal in the Muslim world. But yet, it's the governments that espouse that ideology, it is those governments that are given the top-of-the-line U.S. weaponry, or as close as top-of-the-line as it's willing to export, you know, F-15s, advanced UAVs, and guided missiles, and so on, are all over Saudi Arabia, Qatar, a number of the Emirates, Gulf dictatorships. The U.S. is happy to arm to the teeth governments that are funding these extremists in Syria.
Yes, I mean, they've been they've armed all of these rebels, all of these, well, I don't know if they've armed all of them, but they've certainly been providing arms and direction and assistance to rebels in Syria, rebels who are committing terrible atrocities, and the press and the media kind of minimize that and sweep that under the rug so that we don't notice.
I suppose you could assume that these rebels are going to be clearing the way for a better investment climate in Syria.
I think so. I mean, if you look at, you could speculate about why it is that the United States and other Western powers are interested in overthrowing the government of Assad, and they're quite open about that. And then you look at the economic policies of the Assad government, and they're essentially a policies that investors find to be unattractive. The Syrian government does not provide a very attractive business or foreign investment climate. The Syrian government is an economically nationalist government. In fact, the U.S. State Department, you can read documents from the U.S. State Department where they complain about the Syrian government's adherence to socialist policies and its economic nationalism. That's what puts Syria in the crosshairs of U.S. and Canadian foreign policy, not the fact that, you know, the previous political arrangement was one in which there was one party that had a lead role in the society, not because there's been this ongoing battle between a secular vision of the society represented by Assad and people in his party versus, a fundamentalist Islamic version represented by the Muslim Brotherhood or ISIS and other Al-Qaeda-aligned groups. It's not that really inspires Canada and the United States to try and oust Assad's government. It's partly his economic policies, his anti-colonialism, and his, you know, alliance with Iran and with Hezbollah. And if you want to talk about Iran, too, you could talk about the same kind of economic nationalism and the same kind of business and investment climate that Western investors don't find to be particularly attractive. But they do think that Iran would be quite a lucrative market for an investment and for exports.
Well, you know, if the U.S. thinks that the Middle East could use more democracy, The question is, why aren't its allies target number one? Why isn't Saudi Arabia target number one? Why isn't Qatar target number one? Instead, those countries, those monarchies, are countries through which arms flow to the effort to overthrow Syria. So it shows a wildly different set of priorities than what the media and the U.S. government are espousing as reasons for why the Syrian government should be overthrown. I think it's very frustrating at this point. We've been through too many regime changes just in the last decade and a half in the Middle East. There was great resistance to the attempt last year to escalate the situation in Syria, but now they're coming back into Syria and Iraq because of ISIS, which is the result of the destruction of the functioning Iraqi government and the result of funding of extremists for three or more years trying to overthrow Syria's government. So now, you know, the consequences of U.S. policy are being used to justify further intervention.
Yeah, and I think you could trace ISIS even further back. I mean, I think you could trace, there was the political scientist Robert Pape who looked at what it was that motivated suicide terrorism. And what he found, that a lot of people think this is fundamentalist Muslims are suicide terrorists, but what he found was that the lead suicide terrorists in the world are the Tamil Tigers, who are secular and Marxist-Leninist. So he said it had nothing to do with religion. What it actually had to do with is suicide terrorism, and you can make the same argument about terrorism as well, is what it's motivated by is occupation of homelands that the terrorists regard, or the territory that the terrorists regard as their homeland. They use terrorism because they don't have navies and armies and air forces to do this, but they use whatever means they have to try and drive out foreign militaries from territories they consider to be their own. So, if you go all the way back to the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda eventually arose out of that and this attempt to drive the Soviets out of territory that was considered the homeland of Muslims. But then you have U.S. intervention or U.S. presence, even a military presence in the Middle East, which kind of gave rise to Al-Qaeda. And that eventually morphs into ISIS. And you can really say that ISIS is simply, you know, an extension. The motivation for ISIS's motivation is to drive a Western military presence out of the Middle East.
Well, I don't see how you're going to have moderation and stability as long as there's U.S. military bases, you know, crisscrossing the Middle East and the support of puppet dictatorships, unrepresentative monarchies, and so on. The U.S. is propping up a very unrepresentative and shaky structure there, and they're going to keep doing that as long as they can pump money and arms into there, and you're going to keep seeing these kind of situations. I mean, it really requires a radically different foreign policy, and one that isn't directed towards the need of foreign investment, banks, corporations, and the military establishment, and so on. But that's the policy we have, so these kind of wars are they're going to keep coming.
Yes, they are, and we're going to continue to get blowback as well. And the fact that we get blowback has all kinds of terrible consequences for ordinary Canadians. Not only are we put in harm's way by the fact that there are people who are willing to engage in terrorism to make the point that they want us to stop or to withdraw troops from territory that they consider their homeland, but this then also gives rise to a kind of a strengthening of the police state as the state takes on more authority and encroaches more and more upon civil liberties on the grounds that it has to protect us from the blowback that it itself has produced.
Well, that's a very perceptive. I mean, the continuing lack of security that these interventions create therefore creates this perceived need to intensify a police state. And, you know, as other people have commented, colonialism comes home. You engage in wars abroad and exploitation of other countries. The mechanisms of control that you employ, that your country employs in that country, will come back. And you see that in the case of Iraq, where, you know, they employed these mine-resistant armor vehicles, and then they're employing sound cannons and microwave devices against protesters in Iraq, and many of these devices have come back in recent years to the United States, where they're being used against protesters who are decrying the lack of funding for social programs that has gone to the war. So, you know, that the colonialism and violence that's employed abroad will come home. But, you know, this continuing imperial policy is something that I'm sure, you know, the, what's left in your blog will comment on, and you've been providing useful updates and helpful information. So I thank you for the work you're doing on that subject. I'm sure this foreign investment-driven policy will continue to provide fodder for your website and your analysis. So thanks very much for the articles, and thanks for being on the program with us today.
Thank you for having me. Thanks.
Okay. And that was Stephen Gowans. You can reach his blog, gowans.wordpress.com. It's called What's Left. It's Gowans, G-O-W-A-N-S, .wordpress.com.